Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. This is July 3rd, 1990, in the home of Mr. and Mrs. Earl Weaver in Hialeah, Florida. It is about 9 o'clock in the morning. The interviewer is Dan Austin of Plantation, Florida. This tape is for the archives of the National Baseball Hall of Fame. Mr. Weaver, as this is for the archives, and you have a rich history of baseball that will never be replicated by today's or the generation in the next century. You were a manager, a successful one for many years. You played in the minor leagues as a player. In all those years of baseball, who were the top five managers that you kind of modeled yourself after and picked up tips to be a successful manager yourself?
Well, I would never grade any of my competitors.
Okay.
It wouldn't be right because, number one, I don't know if I'd be qualified or not. Okay. But the second thing is you're always going to leave somebody out.
Mm-hmm.
But naturally, with 20 years in the minor leagues, 9 or 10 as a player and the rest as a minor league manager, you're going to pick up experiences through your own mistakes, through other people's mistakes that you've seen, and also model yourself a little bit after some of the managers you've had. I want to mention two that I had as a player in the minor leagues. George Kissel, who's a longtime baseball man and still in baseball with the St. Louis Cardinals, and another one by the name of Andy Cohen. They were good minor league managers, good people for young players, good teachers, and George Kissel was a perfectionist. I can't say that I modeled myself after these two people, but I certainly learned a lot from them and used some of their theories, both on the field and off the field, as I became a minor league manager and then a major league manager. I was fortunate enough to be in the Baltimore organization as a minor league manager when Paul Richards had the Baltimore Orioles. And Paul had advanced theories for his time, as far as pickoffs, rundowns, different situations in baseball. And again, as a minor league manager, I got to come to the major league camp and observe Richards' theories so that they could be taught throughout the Baltimore organization. And when I got to the big leagues, I used a lot of Paul Richards' theories also. But mm-hmm. those three people, I guess, are the ones, not that they were the best, mm-hmm. I don't want to call them the best or the worst or whatever you'd like to call them, but those are three people that I did use a lot of their philosophies and a lot of their theories. And again, I say off the field and on the field. I think mm-hmm. this fellow Andy Cohen that I played for in Denver and New Orleans might have been the best handler of players that I ever saw. And there again, I'm saying the best, and that might not be true, but he knew how to talk to a person and how to get him to play ball. Not necessarily motivation, but even if it be left alone, Andy was a genius as far as handling his players on and off the field. Paul Richards had great theories, and George Kissel was mm-hmm. the perfectionist who wanted everything done perfect. And if I had to pick three people, or any people, mm-hmm. that whose theories I use, philosophies I've used, those might be the three that really influenced you.
That laid the foundation for your going, getting.
Well, no, I think 20 years in the minor leagues, you learn to do things your way,
yeah.
with the others infiltrated into the same system. But yes, I used a lot of their theories and their philosophies.
I've heard a couple of managers say that there are very few managers who have been successful in working with some of the old-time ball players. And when I say old-time, I'm talking about the 40s and 50s, maybe early 60s, and today's young ball player, that they're different. They come with different attitudes. And I'm not saying one attitude is better than another, but that I've heard stories that very few managers have been able to make that transition in working with
myself. I really don't know if there's a transition or not. Naturally, the salaries are higher, but
yeah.
you had your superstars in the old days. What you wanted on your ball club is a superstar who had pride, wasn't playing for the money. $100,000 in those days was just as astronomical as $1 million contract mm-hmm. today. It takes good scouting. It takes good judgment as to who you want to sign. If you sign the right players, you're going to get your money's worth. If you have to go after the wrong player, you're not going to get your money's worth. I could name you players, and I don't want to name players.
Okay.
Naturally, on this tape, that we're playing for next year's contract, but still wouldn't hustle.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't get the best out of them. And in those days, you'd see that player traded year after year yeah. after year after year. And when you got the player that Brooks Robinson's caliber, you've mm-hmm. seen him stay with one club throughout his mm-hmm. career. He was satisfying everybody. So I don't, myself, and I'm talking about leaving the game in 1982, and that was after free agency, some 8 years after free agency took effect. Yes, you'd see a 3-year contract affect some players,
mm-hmm.
but not, it was the exception rather than the rule. I just want to tell you one story about Kenny Singleton in 1976. Everybody was going to become a free agent, or maybe it was the 75 season, but in 1976 we signed Kenny Singleton for $1 million. That was $200,000 a year. That was unheard of at that mm-hmm. time. I think only one other player had signed at that time, and that was John Mayberry for the same contract.
Mm-hmm.
$200,000 a year for 5 years. Now everybody thought, well, they've got it made for life. Somewhere along the line, John Mayberry disappeared. Ken Singleton played out his career. Mm-hmm. But the story that I want to tell you is the fact that Ken was slow afoot, and at the end of the ball game, a close ball game, I'd pinch run for him. A close ball game, I'd put somebody with a little more speed out in right field. Mm-hmm. And in this particular ball game, we're winning 9-1 or 8-1. I made my usual defensive move, and this is for two reasons. Number one, I thought I'd give Kenny a rest. Number two, it gets you to use all your players and mm-hmm. keeps them sharp. I pinch run for Kenny in the eighth, and he come in, and he had a terrible look on his face and a scowl. And I said, what's wrong with you? He said, how am I going to lead this league in runs scored? And he was a good on-base percentage mm-hmm. man. If you keep taking me out in a ball game like this. Now, he understood the other one, but in this particular case, I don't guess he understood. But how am I going to lead the league? I said, Kenny, what difference does it make? You just signed a contract for 5 years. You're not going to make any more money in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
He said, pride, Earl, pride. And that's the motivation, and that's when you scout and give a man a 4- and 5-year contract, you better look and see what's inside of them and see if that pride is there.
Sure.
And I'd say 90% of the players have that pride, just like in the old days.
Mm-hmm.
I saw players that would not hustle, that would not run balls out, and I'm going way back. I've seen players not make the major leagues. I mean, they had everything to gain and nothing to lose, and as a minor league manager, you could not motivate certain players to get the most out of their ability.
Got gave the talent, but they didn't.
Naturally, they never made the major leagues. Mm-hmm. Then you had players that had so much talent that made it despite that mm-hmm. attitude. And I'm, again, talking old days. And they didn't make the maximum out of what they had. And again, I say those are the players that were traded year
yeah.
after year yeah. after year and wound up with so many different ball clubs.
Okay. You spent several years as a minor league manager. You saw a lot of ballparks. And as a baseball fan, I've gone to most of the major league parks and found them designed more for crowd control than for actually seeing a good game. And what were some of your favorite ballparks as a manager in terms of, you're known as a strategist, you had an incredible amount of information. Were there some favorite ballparks that really fit into the kinds of teams that you had as an Oriole?
No, ours was symmetrical, Memorial Stadium, and you have to say there's no place like home. There was no advantage for right-handed hitters,
mm-hmm.
no advantage for left-handed hitters. We had a powerful club in 1968. One of the first things we did, I said, we got guys that can hit the ball out of the ballpark. We have great defense. When you talk about manicuring your own parks, we brought the fences in 10 feet in 1969. It helped
mm-hmm.
us tremendously. That's just in the alleys and
mm-hmm.
not much in center field, but in the alleys
mm-hmm.
And left center. The other thing with Brooks Robinson, Belanger, and Davey Johnson, Boog Powell was a good defensive first baseman, mm-hmm. too, but that was my infield through the years that we won the three straight American League pennants. Won 109, 108, and 100, I think, mm-hmm. right in a row. What we did there is I got the groundkeeper, Pat Santarone, who was an expert at this, and I looked out there and I said, well, we're not making that spectacular play, and I'm watching people come in from the other teams go in the hole and make that backhanded mm-hmm. catch and throw people out. And I noticed that our infield was very slow. The grass was tall and the dirt mm-hmm. was not packed as mm-hmm. tightly as it could be. And I asked him if he could speed this infield up just a little bit, cut the grass just a little bit closer to make the ball go through the infield mm-hmm. faster. Because my fellas were great defensively with a great range. Well, what was happening is the ball would be so slow, we'd be in front of everything, and the slow infielder was just getting to it and throwing mm-hmm. us out. So what we did is we quickened up the infield, and all of a sudden I seen our ground balls going through. That infielder that didn't have that extra amount of range would not get to the ball, and Belanger, Johnson, and Brooks would make those great plays. So that's one way that you can manicure your home park. But as far as going on the road, you're at the mercy. When you go one into Fenway, they usually had eight right-handed hitters, mm-hmm. and your left-handed hitters were at a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. But as far as picking a favorite park, I never had a favorite park. I guess the two prettiest from 68 till they have some of the new ones, mm-hmm. and I haven't seen some of the new mm-hmm. ones that are have just been built in the major leagues. But the two prettiest were the one in Anaheim and Kansas City, I guess, was the prettiest to look at, but not necessarily to play ball in, because there was one tailored for their ball club, speed. At that time, I didn't have a lot of speed on the ball club, and speed in the outfield. So
and Kansas City had
artificial
stuff
all the way, and they had a lot of they won the ball games on speed.
Yeah.
Ground balls through the infield. Their outfielders would catch up with the fly balls. Uh-huh. And well, it was my favorite park to look at. I wasn't happy about going in there and playing.
Mm-hmm. What city in the majors? And of course, you're probably more familiar with the American League. Did you find the fans most knowledgeable and really weren't out there just to drink beer and raise cane, but really knew some of the subtleties of the game?
Well, the same ones, I guess, where the fans went out there to drink beer and raise heck. Take Chicago, New York, and Detroit.
Uh-huh.
Probably one of the three older mm-hmm. franchises, and their people were brought up with the Cubs in Chicago, the Cubs and the White Sox, mm-hmm. inside and out. They love baseball. The Tiger fans, where they draw a lot of people every year, in New mm-hmm. York, certainly, where they had three baseball clubs at one time, now down to two, and at one time down to one, mm-hmm. but they grew up with it all their lives, and they were knowledgeable baseball. They were rowdy, but they were knowledgeable.
Mm-hmm.
The people in Baltimore had baseball all their lives, so they were knowledgeable fans. But
well, I always
just
thought
fantastic people. They were polite mm-hmm. in a manner.
Yeah.
Even they would cheer the opposition, whereas mm-hmm. Chicago, Detroit, and New York, they didn't cheer
the
opposition. They were real homers. But I guess that's the way you're supposed to be. Mm-hmm. The people in Baltimore, while they rooted for us and treated us like kings, were very polite to the opposition. And at first, when Baltimore just got back into the major leagues, I mean, their thrill was going out to see Mickey Mantle and mm-hmm. some of the players they had read about on the opposing club. So early, and I'm talking about 54, long before I got there, I worked in the organization in 59, and we'd go up for our organizational mm-hmm. meetings and everything, and I was amazed at how I'm from St. Louis, and we used to boo the opposition and taunt the opposition. That's where I grew up. But the fans in Baltimore were out there to appreciate baseball and give the opposition just as big a hands and cheers as they were their home team.
I remember when I lived in
other cities are like that, too. Anaheim mm-hmm. will do that.
Same thing.
Los Angeles, I guess. And again, I don't know any of the National League cities. Texas, which is a new franchise, mm-hmm. Where it was like Baltimore mm-hmm. and appreciated the opposition.
Mm-hmm. I grew up in Kansas City, Mr. Weaver, and so I grew up with the Yankee, with the Yankee Farm Club, the old Kansas City Blues, mm-hmm. and the American Association. But once a year, my uncle and aunt would take me down to Sportsman's Park, for a weekend and either see the St. Louis Browns that later became the Orioles or the Cardinals play. So I remember some of the tactics of the Cardinal fans, and I said, wow. But
yeah, well, they were tough.
The Cardinal,
and it was a different, believe it or not, it was a different type of, when you went to see the Browns, other than the year 1944 when they won the American League pennant, you went out to see Hal Neuhauser pitch, you went out to see Bobby Feller pitch, and you went out to see DiMaggio come in. You went out to see the opposition.
Mm-hmm.
My father was a Browns fan, and he had wanted me to sign with the Browns. And eventually, that's who,
I
spent my career with, because they went over to Baltimore. But it was different than going to a Cardinal game and a Browns game. Mm-hmm. Now, I'll tell you, I was one of the fortunate people who got to see approximately 100 major league games a year, probably from the time I was 10 years old until I got out of high school.
How'd you work that?
Well, we had two teams in St. Louis, and I had a knothole card from both of them. I was fortunate to have an uncle and aunt who held season tickets for both of them. And my father cleaned the uniforms for both ball clubs. That was his business. In fact, I was walking in the clubhouse in 1935, 36 as a 5 and 6 year old, just looking around at Pepper Martin's uniform and even DeRocher's, Dizzy Dean. He'd let me drive over to the park with him when he picked up the uniforms either after the game, and they were all day games then, so
you'd
get the uniforms at 5:30 or 6 o'clock, and we'd bring them to the plant, and then we'd go home, and that went on for years and years and years. I went to high school 2.5 blocks at Beaumont High School, 2.5 blocks away from Sportsman's Park, so I could go over and catch the fourth inning, third, fourth, and fifth inning right after school let out. So, you know, I just saw as many baseball games as I could, and when you figure they played 154-70 each, I wouldn't miss 50 games a year. I probably saw 100 ball games a year, major league games.
So you grew up in the tradition.
Well, I was second-guessing Billy Southworth when he won 100 games 3 years in a row in 1941 and 1942. You know, I was a regular fan, and why is he taking him out, or why don't he take him out? Well, we can't do it while she's on the phone, can we?
Sorry.
Well, how'd that come about that you were selected Oriole manager in the midway through the 68 season?
Well, it's hard for me to really know. I had worked for Baltimore and been happy to work for Baltimore because as a 17-year-old, I got out of high school, signed a professional contract, and that was all I knew. So a fellow by the name of Jim McLaughlin, who had worked for the St. Louis Browns as farm director, hired me as a minor league manager. They had tried to sign me as a player, but I was a St. Louis Cardinal fan, but and one end of the Cardinal organization. But they had, and Jim decided to give me a job as a Class D manager. His assistant at that time was Harry Dalton, young fella who's now who was general manager of Baltimore, went out to California, general manager, and is now general manager of the Milwaukee Brewers. But at any rate, Harry and I were close, and we worked together throughout the minor leagues. He was the assistant farm director. I was the minor league manager. I had success in all the cities that I had managed, worked my way up through the minor league system, and in that time, all classifications, D, C, B, A, AA, and AAA, and had managed in all of the classifications for him. Because of that, I was awarded the first base coaching job. I had success as a manager, but awarded the first base coaching job. Now, the history on the major leagues is the fact that Baltimore had won the pennant in 4 straight in the World Series in 1966. In 1967, Frank Robinson slid into second base. Chicago, a fellow by the name of Weiss, and injured himself and had double vision, was out the second half of the 67 season. Naturally, maybe some complacency set in with some of the other ball players, but they went straight to seventh place after winning the pennant. Fans naturally become disgruntled. Harry Dalton had worked his way up to farm director and working under Lee McPhail for a while, but then the National Brewing Company Jerry Hoffberger, who was the owner of the club, brought in Frank Cashin, who's now the general manager of the New York Mets. Frank was fresh and liked fresh faces, and Harry Dalton, as the farm director and assistant general manager then, was able to convince him during the 1968 season. Now, let me say that I don't think it was anything other than losing Frank Robinson for a half a season that tore them from a championship club all the way down. Now, whether you can replace a Frank and stay competitive, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Maybe the club did get a little complacent. I think that was what Harry's thought was. But anyway, in the 1968 season, like all towns, they got 14 games out of first place by All-Star break time. Fans started to get disgruntled. They were spoiled now with a winner in 1966. Mm-hmm. They start booing. They quit coming through the turnstiles. And this is just something that happens in baseball. And when that starts to happen, they have to make a change.
You need to find a new manager than an entire ball field.
Well, you didn't need a new ball club. Yeah. We found that out. But Frank was not a healthy player the first half of that season either, and one of the reasons that they were 14 games out. He was struggling at around 200 because he had missed a half of the season the year before. But at any rate, for reasons, as I've mentioned, fan discontent, really loss at the turnstile is a big one, and the boos that you hear in the stands, they let Hank go. At that time, Frank came back strong and had a good second half of 68. I did make a few changes myself. We got the organization to go out and get Mike Cuellar. Jim Russo and Harry Dalton had a lot to do with that trade. I had managed in Puerto Rico that winter, and I had saw Cuellar pitch, and I wanted him badly. And they went out and got Cuellar. Along with that, I made a few minor changes where I start platooning the catchers. I had seen Elrod Hendricks in Puerto Rico and knew he could hit some home runs for us. And he became a platoon player with Andy Etchebarren, where we got 20 home runs back out of our catchers, and inserted Donnie Buford, who might have been the best leadoff man in baseball for a three-year period, 110 walks, 110 runs scored, 19 home runs, and a .300 batting average.
He was on base half the time, almost.
Yes, and a great on-base percentage. Talked him into trying to get walks. Now, he didn't like to walk, but I talked him into saying, you're going to play regular here. And I rotated him. Pat, not a real good defensive player. I won't call him a bad one, but rotated him back and forth. I had seen him play. I first saw Don Buford in Lincoln, Nebraska in 1961 or 1962. Chicago had made him an infielder, thinking that he was too small to be an outfielder and didn't hit enough home runs. But when we traded for Donnie, I got him in the lineup, and it made all the difference in the world. Frank kind of helped take over the clubhouse for me and get the attitude right once he started playing good again. Frank was a great leader by example, by doing everything on the field. There's a player that you could have given a five-year contract to, and he'd have went into second base just as hard to break up that double play as anybody you've ever seen. But that was the circumstances, and everything seemed to gel, and we won a pennant the first 3 years.
Another question. You had a fantastic pitching squad back in those days. As a manager, when you went out there to yank or one of your pitchers in the rotation, and you heard a lot of boos in the crowd, you ever second-guess yourself and say, hey, maybe I better keep this guy in anyway?
Not till you got back to the dugout. The second-guess didn't happen until after the results. But over it all, after it's all said and done, I think my decisions, and I got a lot of help from George Bamberger, who was a great pitching coach. A lot of my, all I can say is my decisions were, turned out to be all right, because I was there for 16 straight years and never was fired. So the only way you're not going to get fired is put enough wins on the board against losses so that you'll be asked back next year.
And you're one of the top 10 managers in winning percentage.
Well, at any rate, you had to make up your mind. You had to do it. Didn't know if it was going to be right or wrong. And it's not guesswork. It's who's out in that bullpen, and that's where my statistics came in handy. At least I knew what the hitter at the plate was hitting against the pitcher I was going to bring in or the pitcher that was on the mound. If Jim Palmer was on the mound and Greg Nettles was 1-for-25 against Palmer, I'm going to leave him in. Yeah. if he was 10 for 25 and I had a guy, Eddie Watt, we'll say, or Pete Rickard or Don mm-hmm. Ossie or whoever it might be, where Nettles is 0 for 15 mm-hmm. or something against him, that helped me make my decision, and they turned out pretty good.
Mr. Weaver, I know it's time to go.
You got one more quickie?
Okay, well, let me... I have a whole two, three pages full. I didn't bring my reading glasses in, but...
Yeah, you want to try these?
Okay, let me try these, okay? I just have drugstore variety. Yeah, those are wonderful. I'm going to speak as a fan. If you don't want to respond to this, fine, but... I've had a lot of problems with both owners and players. This is just myself talking with the lockout that occurred this spring and the kinds of salaries. Do you see, what would you say to owners and players so that they don't, that it doesn't affect the way the public perceives the game going into the next century?
I don't think I'm capable of giving that kind of advice,
okay.
But I wish the fan would just remember, whether it be baseball, basketball, or anything else. You go over to the Lipton tennis match, which they have here in Miami, mm-hmm. and a hamburger is $6.50. The tennis players are making an ungodly amount yeah. of money, and so are the golfers. Mm-hmm. So it's just the sign of our times, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, a box of popcorn used to cost a nickel in a show, and now it's $1.50. So
yeah.
what are you going to do?
Yeah.
Everything is relative as far as I'm concerned.
You were noted to be a great strategist, have a lot of information about opposing batters, what your pitchers could do. Do you remember a couple of games where that really paid dividends, that strike in your mind, that all this wealth of information, and you went out there, you made that pitching change or batting change, and you say, hey, I'm in the groove?
Well, the bad ones usually come to mind.
Well, I was thinking about the good ones.
Well, just let me give you an example
okay.
of a bad one. Jim Palmer's on the mound pitching to Greg Nettles, and Nettles had some success against Palmer.
Mm-hmm.
Nettles was 1 for 21 off of Tippy Martinez.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was over, had to be over a 3 or 4 year period because
mm-hmm.
Tippy is a chart reliefer
mm-hmm.
and used
mm-hmm.
in the 8th and 9th inning to
yeah.
get certain hitters out,
mm-hmm.
and Greg Nettles was one of them. But Jim Palmer was on the mound, and some time back, it was 1 for 21, and the hit was a home run. And this, again, over a three-year period, I went out to get Palmer, and he saw Tippy walking in. He said, don't you remember what happened? I said, I know exactly what happened. This guy is 1 for 21
mm-hmm.
off of Tippy.
Yeah.
And he's got one out to get. And the tying runs on first. Nettles is the winning run. So Palmer said, well, you evidently don't remember what happens, what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how many years ago that had been because
mm-hmm.
it was a running total over the years, but I knew 1 for 21 put the advantage in my favor. Well, Tippy threw one pitch. It went up in the second deck, and the ball game was over. Now he's 2 for 22. So both of them cost us ball games.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like to say the other 20 times we were right because it had to be the same situation,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Same.
So there's 20 times I was right and twice I was
That's
wrong, and I'll take those.
You'll
odds.
Take the 20 out of 22. Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Weaver, for sharing those moments. And as I said, I'll get this tape to you for your review and wait until I hear from the word. Send it up to the Baseball Hall of Fame.
All right. Very good.
Thank you very much,
okay.
sir.
Okay. I wish we'd have had a little more.